Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I am Ann Clark, member of the club's Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. As I mentioned, I will be your chair and moderator for tonight's program. I'm delighted to introduce you tonight to Robert Emery Smith, whom I know as Bob Smith, who has brought us a wonderful wealth of information about a task that he and his partner Galen took on. Bob is the Director of Technology Services for Stanford Center for Innovation and Learning and one of the systems engineers that was involved for the creation of Wallenberg Hall. Those of you who know Stanford know that Wallenberg Hall was damaged in the earthquake. It's a historical building, and Bob did this absolutely amazing job of restoring and preserving the historical element and feel of the building while transferring the interior of the building into what is now called a classroom of the future or a innovative learning center. Bob graduated from the Stanford University Smart Project Design Program and pursued a career in commercial product design and project management. He did projects for the Veterans Administration, Intex, David Kelly Design, Tandem Corporation, Golf Pro International. And he came to Stanford's Learning Center in 2000 to manage the design and implementation of Wallenberg and really create one of the very first technological classroom learning centers of the future. That center has had international respect and regard for the work that Bob did and really setting the stage for what we can imagine for classrooms for the future. So it's with a great deal of honor, I feel, and respect and love that I introduce you to Bob Smith.
Thank you all very much for coming out this evening. Is this on? And thank you, Anne, for the opportunity to speak in this forum. As a native San Franciscan, I've been aware of the Commonwealth Club basically since I could start listening to the radio, and it's just I'd never had considered the possibility that I'd be here talking to an audience some evening. So it's an exciting and delightful opportunity, and I really appreciate the chance to be here. Anne knows me, obviously, from the Stanford side of things. She knows me from the Wallenberg Hall project, which is a big project a pretty exciting one, but it's quite a bit different than the project we're going to be talking about tonight. For one thing, that building is about 55 times the size of the building that we're going to be talking about tonight. So the issues that you address there and how you address them are quite different than what you do with a 1,000-square-foot cabin. Let me start by giving you a quick overview of where I'm going to be coming from in this talk. We didn't start out to create a greenhouse. It wasn't the situation that we were reading about global warming and watching the various movies and news coverages that are coming out about it and deciding, we need to do something. It was much less dramatic than that. We had a leaky roof. And as these things go, that led to a variety of exciting opportunities, and the tradition took off from there. The first date that's relevant to what we're going to be talking about tonight is 1930, because 1930 is when the original cabin that we're talking about was built. 1930 was an interesting time because it was right before the end of Prohibition, and there was actually quite a large number of small cabins built up in this part of the country. This is south San Mateo County up in the coastal range along Skyline in that area. And it was the tradition back then to take advantage of a peculiarity of the coastal geography, which was down in Half Moon Bay. In Half Moon Bay, there's quite a large number of small and very well secluded coves down there, and not surprisingly, some of our entrepreneurial folks found that was a really extraordinary place to bring Canadian whiskey in to the United States on small boats, offload them in the secluded cove, and then distribute them to a thirsty populace. And to support that particular industry, or to foster their enjoyment of that industry, a lot of people were building cabins down in the forests down there, basically so they could come down from San Francisco on a Friday night, hit Half Moon Bay, pick up a little refreshment or something there, and then take it up into the mountains and spend the rest of the weekend enjoying the forest. Yeah. So this cabin was built in that context. Okay, this was not built as a primary family home. It was not built as an estate or anything like you would find a little farther down the hill, you know, the Folger Estate and things like that. It was a cabin that was basically put together for weekend drinking. In 1945, another interesting phenomena in the Bay Area took place, and that was the end of World War II, in which case an awful lot of people came back from the Pacific Theater, came through San Francisco, were mustered out in San Francisco, and stayed. And as a consequence, the population of the San Francisco Bay Area grew pretty substantially that year and continued to grow thereafter. And that put some pressure on housing, and so we saw some interesting phenomena taking place in the years following. One of them was that small, borderline, very... I guess the appropriate technical word is sketchy. Cabins were being pressed into service as primary residences. That's what happened to our place. In roughly 1975, it looks like it was then that the cabin received its first real foundation, which is not bad. 45 years sitting on the ground is not a bad deal. It also received the two larger rooms and the kitchen and bathrooms that are currently featured in the cabin. In 1988, a very important thing happened. I came on the scene. I had come off the experience of working at my first startup company, and with the ill-gotten gains from that activity, I was able to buy my first house. And in 1988, you know, I was 28, 29 years old. That was a really early time for someone my age to be able to buy a house. So it was a very exciting, exciting moment. In 1998, totally unrelated to our cabin, someone that Lynn Hammerschmidt knows well and respects, Sarah Suzanka, wrote a book called The Not-So-Big House. And what she was writing about in that situation was in reaction to a trend that she'd been seeing in home design and family living that had been taking place over probably the previous 10 years, which was the drive towards what's colloquially referred to as McMansions, starter castles, things like that, really large houses. I found it fascinating recently. I was flipping through a copy of a magazine that devotes itself to modern home design and remodeling and all that. And one of the articles, in flipping through, we came across the quote that said something to the effect of, we gave a couple of architects our brief for our house, and it was that we wanted to have 90% footfall each week in each of the rooms in the house. So 90% of the rooms in the house would have someone in a four-person family step into them at least every week. That was their spec for the house, which is, that's kind of a mind-boggling notion to me. You know, that, I don't know how you live in a place that just meets a spec like that, but, you know, whatever works, I guess. Finally, in 2005, a very important thing happened, and that was an attempt to re-roof the house with composite shingling. Failed, and it became very apparent that the structure of the house, which had been put up back in 75, this back part of the house back there, it became apparent that, in fact, what had happened was apparently the people who built this cut down one of the trees on the property, cut it up into lumber there on the property, and, of course, being green-oriented at the time, they didn't take one of the big trees, so they made a small tree do, and so the rafters, the things that were holding up the roof, were smaller than contemporary 2x4s. And as a consequence, the roof had a pronounced sway to it, and as anyone who's played around with roofing technology will tell you, that's not a good place to start. And it finally got to the point where it had failed. So with that moment, it was time to start planning what we would do with the place. This is what the cabin looked like at that point. The original cabin, I don't know if I can get it from here, but the central section here under this one central pitched roof is the actual original cabin, which was about 12 feet wide and about 20 feet long. This section out here on the left was a porch that had been added sometime later on, but was certainly there by 1975, and then walled in and roofed off. When I bought the place, it had a flat plywood roof with the skylight in it. And then the back of the house, over here is where the bedrooms and the kitchen and all the operating parts of the house are. As you can see, that's me standing there walking down the steps in the front of it. It's not what you'd call a high roof. It's actually quite low. The plate height on the walls, the height of the walls where they meet the ceiling in the house, really didn't get much above 7 feet in the house. And so the end result of this was the whole place felt a little constrained. It felt a little low. Of course, I didn't really know that until we had determined several years earlier that some windows leaked and I needed to replace those windows. When I found out what it cost to replace the windows, I decided to do what I really wanted to do, and we put in this this greenhouse off one side of the living room. That was the one part of the house that we really liked. Really, really liked that house. And so to that end, we started looking for an architect to work with because we realized that it was more than just changing a roof. It turns out in the county of San Mateo, and I imagine everywhere else in the civilized world, if you're going to change the roof line of a house, if you're going to change how the roof is constructed, basically the rest of the house has to be brought up to code. This for a recreational cabin built 70 years before, right? I mean, that's kind of a scary prospect. So we found a contractor, or not a contractor, but an architect, who got the job when he walked in the first time he saw the house and looked up and said, "Oh, yeah, if you want the rest of the house to look like this, well, we could just pop up a clear story at the top of it, and we could put some windows along the side, and we'd get, you know, sunlight coming in on all sides. It'd be, yeah, it'd be just like the rest of the little greenhouse here." And I said, "Great, you got it. You got the job." And a few months later, we actually had a set of drawings that came out of that. That's what the front of the house was designed to look like. You can see that the greenhouse windows are still there, as well as the thing that we often refer to among ourselves and our friends as the horse barn clerestory. And if you look at horse barns in California, they have that same kind of roof line where there's slanted roofs coming up, a clerestory for windows to let the light in so the horses don't stumble in the dark, and then a little peaked roof on top of that. So that was the project that we would take off on. Since we were doing this, it seemed only responsible at the time that we think seriously about what does it take to make a house like this green. In doing Wallenberg Hall, we'd had a lot of exposure to LEED measurements of buildings, and as a matter of fact, that building, while it's very efficient, is not LEED rated. And the reason is that they were trying to stuff so much stuff under a fixed size building that we really just wanted to avoid that whole issue rather than getting into it. But it was clear to me that there was more to just this green notion than just going out and buying a particular kind of paint or selecting the appropriate compact fluorescent light bulb or putting flow reducers in all the shower nozzles. And so in poking around about that, and this is something I've been idly doing for quite some time, we came across a lot of different definitions, some of them very technical, dealing with, you know, the embodied energy of the building and so forth. Some of them a little more straightforward, like, you know, well, is it nice to live in? Is it good for the environment? Which is a really soft concept if you think about it. I mean, doing good for the environment in a way that isn't good from the very beginning of the process that you're going to undertake all the way through to the end is probably probably not responsible and probably not what you really hope to do. One definition that we came across was this one. So efficiently using energy, water, and other resources, fair enough. Protecting occupant health and improving employee productivity. Well, we don't have any employees at the house, so that was pretty easy. Reducing waste, pollution, and environmental degradation. The thing that's difficult about definitions like this is efficiently using energy, water, and other resources. Our first impulse on this is to look at our monthly bill. You know, what's the water bill? What's the energy bill? What's PG&E charging us this month? But in fact, you have to look a little bit farther back than that. In fact, you need to think about what the total energy life cycle for a building and all the things in it is going to be. That includes the energy that's required to create the material that goes into the building in the first place. It's the energy to transport whatever material you're going to be building the space with to the site. And, of course, the energy to assemble it into the building that you're wanting it to be. Ultimately, it has to include the amount of energy that's going to take and operate and maintain it. That's the bill. That item is the PG&E bill and the water bill and the things that we pay for as we go. It's the actual living in it and operating it time. And then in the end of things, the amount of energy it's going to take to disassemble this facility and ultimately recycle and dispose of the material. If you go to a dump these days, and there are relatively few dumps, there are increasingly numbers of transfer stations, you'll find that if you show up with a pickup truck full of concrete blocks and random other gear, they're not welcoming. You know, they really don't want that. They want to find ways of repurposing, recycling, diverting things from landfill as much as possible, which is a suitable form of stewardship. So this notion of where the house eventually has to go is an important one. So with all these things kind of bubbling through your mind, I mean, this again, none of this is really going to inform a casual weekend trip to Home Depot, right? I mean, this is fairly involved stuff. The question that we've got to ask is, you know, what kind of measures can we take to make a livable home, that is to say, a space that you'd actually want to be in, that reflects those goals? From a perspective of sustainability, a monastic existence, you know, wearing a rough woven hood and living in a stone cloister is eminently sustainable, but it's not something that most of us aspire to, much less actually achieve. And so creating a living space that is created or conceived from a mindset of correcting all that is wrong that went before is not a win. That's not the sort of thing that makes you take out the kinds of loans that it takes to create a space like this. What you're looking for is a positive motivation. Oh, he laughs back there. My partner's laughing as I'm saying this. What you're looking for is a positive motivation. You know, how do you get something out of this that you actually want to live in that makes it worth taking whatever measures you need to do to be responsible while you're doing it? So let's do a quick listing, and it is a very quick listing, of the sorts of things that we could engage with in this kind of situation. So, for example, we could engage with low volatile organic compound devices, paints, sealers, adhesives, stone in the construction, radiant barrier roofing, insulated plumbing, house wrap, all sorts of other things. There's a few things we could talk about here tonight. I don't even have time to let you read that whole thing. Suffice it to say, there's a lot of things that could come into this, and it's a long conversation, and it's a conversation that is best engaged with people who spend their time doing this on a daily basis. So let's do this. Let's decimate this list quite a bit and just pick a few things we can talk about. Let's pick the four things on the left, and let's call them envelope efficiency. Creating a space that is, the walls and roof and surround of the house, and how do you make that efficient to keep heat in, keep heat out, whatever it is you're trying to get at. I want to look at a particular device that's used in a room of the house that's not generally thought of in terms of efficiency in the space, that being an induction stovetop. We'll talk about LED lighting, which is a particular fascination of mine for years. I had the privilege of working with a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant electrical engineer who reached one of the peaks of his personal nirvana the day that DigiKey finally shipped him his very first blue LED, which was scary. I think he paid $40 for the thing. Now think about this. This is a light that's this big, just a bare LED. It was $40 back in about 1988 or 89. It's been a long interest. Of course, he would have bought anything that had blue anything, blue anodized metal and black Cordura, and he was there. He was all set. And then finally, we'll talk a little bit about home automation and the role that current technologies can play in fostering all of the agendas that we started out mentioning. So now we'll get into the science. This won't last long, I promise. I'm sorry?
We need to take a quick break for me. To remind the radio audience that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, we are talking with Robert Emery Smith about his personal experience as a homeowner and designer in restoring an old cabin into his and his partner's green tech home.
So to this notion of envelope efficiency, let's talk about roofs first and outside walls of the house first. And in the context of doing that, I want to give you a basis of where we're going to be going with this. What you're looking at there is a very scary-looking graph with lots of scientific notation across the bottom of it, helpfully just an arrow pointing up on the left side saying, you know, increasing flux or something. What that is a way of looking at what the ratios of colors of light there are in sunlight. You remember Sir Isaac Newton had that prism experiment where he'd shine sunlight into it and the prism broke it up into a rainbow of colors, showing that white light is in fact made up of a lot of different wavelengths of color, right? Well, sunlight is made up of a lot more than what we think of as white light. As a matter of fact, what we think of as light in general pretty much happens right in here in this rainbow-colored range, and then there's ultraviolet light from the sun that tails off. But then there's this long tail on the other side with a huge amount of area underneath it that is infrared light. That's to say light that is darker or lower in color than red is. Red goes down to kind of deep red, the red that you get from a glowing electric heating element or something like that. Going darker than that, deeper into the color range than that, is a very heat-intensive and heat-bearing set of wavelengths that are generated in large scale by the sun. And so if you're going to build an effective roof on a house that is to be green, one of the things you've got to deal with is, what are you going to do with all of this infrared energy coming into the space? One of the responses that's being used a lot in commercial work these days, and I'm sure some of you who've worked with us have seen this, are white roofs, where they basically come in and either do a metallized surface on the roof or just do a white painted or white material surface on commercial roofs. And, in fact, you can drop the electrical load for cooling that building pretty substantially by just using that broad white-colored top surface reflecting and rejecting the infrared energy of the sun that's falling upon it. We didn't even try to run that idea past San Mateo County. You know, the cabin that we're talking about is in a corridor, a scenic corridor, alongside some beautiful highways up in the redwoods. Lots of people going up for bike rides and car tours and such on the weekends. The last thing that the County of San Mateo would approve would be a cabin down off the road with a brilliant white roof on it. That's just like not an answer they would consider. So good for commercial, good for warehouses, good for roofs of skyscrapers and things like that. Not so good in a situation where you can actually see the roof of the house in a forested setting. So what's next? Well, the next option is I want to take you back to the days when you were walking around barefoot and in the summertime. There are some pavements that you don't want to go onto with shoes on, much less barefoot, right? I mean, pavement in the summertime, the black asphalt, it gets hot. It gets seriously hot. Makes sense. It's the opposite of the white that we've been talking about as rejecting heat. It absorbs all of that infrared energy and keeps it inside. But even on the hottest days, even on the absolute hottest days of July and August, I doubt very much that you've ever had the experience of brushing up against a tree and getting burned by a leaf. Why is that? I mean, if you think about it, if black is absorbing enough energy to be able to get hot enough to melt the soles of your shoes, how is it that very dark green leaves on trees aren't getting at least seriously warm in the process? But they really don't. And there's an interesting phenomenon about that. And it's the notion of, you know, what is the true color of what it is we're looking at? We talked about the colors here, that little rainbow segment that that we were looking at. And in that range that we can see in that little small rainbow range that we can see in, we determine what we perceive the colors of things to be. Here's a nice green tree with nice green leaves. But if you happen to have the technology, and it's an old technology, to look at that in a wavelength other than the ones we're sensitive to look at it down in the infrared range, out in that long tail on the graph where all the heat is being carried by the sun, you'll see the trees look quite a bit different. Leaves look white in the infrared. So in the visible range, they look green to dark green, light green, some color of green. But the minute you get down into that heavy heat load version of things, they're brilliant white. They're, in fact, reflecting heat. They're reflecting energy and not absorbing it, which is why you don't get burned. Well, it turns out years ago, some very clever people at BASF in Germany figured out a way to make paint that way. The first time I encountered it was with a 1986 black BMW motorcycle that I loved to death. It was a wonderful machine, beautiful black machine, big silver engine on it and all that. And the peculiar thing about it was you could park it out in the sun any day of the summer and it never got hot, which flew counter to every experience I'd ever had with a black car, much less black upholstery. It turns out that the BASF paint engineers had found a way to play this trick. So then in the visible range, it's whatever color you want it to appear to be, but in the infrared range, it's light gray to white. In the visible range, I can show you what a roof like that looks like. This is the roof that's on the cabin. Nice, deep forest green, except in the infrared, it's white or light gray. So we're in a happy situation that the outside shell of the house is intrinsically equipped to reject radiant heat that's falling on it. Let's look at what the rest of the construction of a roof looks like. So if we have our canonical house with a peaked roof here, and we zoom in on it a little bit, we can see that it has a bunch of components to it, including the rafters that we have supporting the roof. We have the cladding material, the plywood that makes up the actual skin of the roof, and then there's tar paper that goes on top of that. Tar paper can come in different colors as well. As it turns out, ours is, oddly enough, a light gray tar paper. I'd never seen that before. It's fascinating. And then on the top layer, there's the green metal roof on the outside. Well, there's another aspect to this roof that has a similar trick that it plays with infrared heat and how it rejects it or accepts it. And we owe this aspect of the house design to John Hammersmith, the contractor, who was aware of this technology and recommended it, and we jumped on it. We thought it was a wonderful idea. Just as the outside of the roof is equipped to reject sunlight, you know, that's not necessarily a common thing. That's not something you can expect every roof to be able to do. For those roofs that can't do that, that have composite shingles or other kinds of shingles on them, there is a roof cladding or the plywood that goes on the roof that is designed to address that. I mentioned that black is really good at absorbing heat. Things thermodynamically in radiant heating, this is back in the mechanical engineering days, I'm sorry to bother you with all this, but things that are good at absorbing heat are good at giving it off as well. It turns out things that are absorbers are emitters as well. And so if you can find a way to make something not a good absorber, you've also found it a way, you found a way for it to not be a good emitter. And so there's a class of plywood made for roofing specifically that has a very shiny layer of aluminum applied to the inside surface of it. The consequence of that is that you end up with this aluminum layer on the underside of the roof such that even when that roof gets hot, because the composite on top of it or the slate on top of it or whatever you've got on top of it has gotten hot, even though the wood gets hot, it's not physically able to radiate that heat into the house. The consequence of this, that John pointed out and predicted and we actually experienced, was that in summertime, when houses under construction are normally, even though they're open-walled still, when they have ceilings on them, they're fairly hot places to be. They feel actively warm, even when it's even, you know, mildly warm outside. With that aluminum sheeting in place, that's not the case. It was a pretty remarkable effect. Well, we've already got a cool roof on the outside of the place. Why do we care? Because we know that piece of wood's not going to get hot. Well, if it's not a good emitter, then that conversely means it's not a good absorber either. So in the wintertime, when that outside surface is cold, is at whatever ambient temperature it happens to be at, that aluminum surface provides a means of basically bouncing any heat that might radiate from inside the house out back into the house. It rejects transfer of heat back out of the space as well. So to recap, we've got our rafters, we've got our deck, the plywood deck with the sparkly aluminum stuff underneath it, and then we've got the tar paper on top of that, and we've got the cool roof on top of that, and then the pièce de résistance to get us to the point where we've really got a nice envelope created around this house. We're going to spray polyurethane foam in between all the rafters and between all the joists of the wall and all of the outside walls. Sprayed polyurethane foam is an unusual kind of insulation. Most of us are used to that horrible, itchy, pink fiberglass stuff that you stick up between things and kind of staple in place. This stuff is a much bigger production to install because people have to come out with a couple of 55-gallon drums of chemistry to react. One of the drums of chemicals is agriculturally based. Some of it's made from corn, some of it's made from soybeans, whatever. The other one is a petroleum distillate. It's an isocyanate, nasty, horrible stuff. But when they react together, they create this non-reactive, very benign polyurethane foam. And you've seen polyurethane foam in lots of places. I mean, their mattress is made out of polyurethane foam, pillows made out of it. This is not the cuddly kind of polyurethane foam. It's actually quite stiff. But what's interesting about it is when you spray it into the walls, in its liquid form, it gets into all the cracks and crevices and covers all those surfaces. It adheres to all those surfaces, then foams, But as it foams, it's not foaming like a sponge where there are cells that are open that can suck up water and all that. It's foaming like the styrofoam that you'd find in an old-style styrofoam coffee cup or in an igloo cooler that you might carry your soft drinks in the summertime. And as a consequence, while we've taken care of radiant heat transfer through the two roof layers that we were talking about, this deals with a different kind of heat transfer, and that's heat transfer that's associated with the movement of mass. Drafts, as we often refer to them, you know, air moving through a wall, even on a small level, can cause a pretty substantial amount of heat exchange. Fiberglass doesn't do a whole lot to stop that. Fiberglass is good at preventing heat from being conducted through the space just by contact conduction. It's not very good at preventing airflow through. You'll see a lot of houses under construction these days that end up with Tyvek wrapped around them like they're some kind of big industrial Christmas present or something. That Tyvek membrane is there to prevent airflow and water flow in and out of the walls. So it's sort of a last-ditch effort. This house has Tyvek around the outside of it as well, but it also has this polyurethane foam sprayed in on the inside. And this is what that looks like in installation. You'll see on the walls, the bright green is the polyurethane foam that's been shot in. You'll see that there are some light fixtures that are waiting to be surrounded up here. And if you look up at the top, you'll see the silver of the radiant battery or plywood that's being buried behind the polyurethane foam. Here's what another room looks like with that technology applied to it. And here's another thing with that technology. Okay. So we've got the environmental envelope for the house under control. We're not radiating heat in or out. We're not convecting heat in or out. We're not conducting heat in or out. Pretty tight space. Let's go on to another area where, as I said before, we don't often think about dealing with efficiency, and that's cooking. When was the last time you heard about someone talking about an efficient stove? Right, it's kind of an interesting notion. If you think about what the traditional mode of cooking is, you know, you've got a fire or an electric resistance burner in the stove that gets put in contact with the bottom of a pot. It's at a higher temperature than the bottom of the pot. It starts driving heat across the junction between them. It turns out that junction between them is a huge thermal resistance. It's a terrific resistance. Even just a little bit of unevenness on the bottom of the pot, great resistance. So you have to drive that temperature up a lot to drive it across the bottom. Then, of course, when you're cranking up your Wolf stove and going to town with it in a big way, the inevitable happens, and a lot of the heat doesn't end up going into the bottom of your pot of oatmeal. It goes blowing around the sides of the pot and up the sides. As a consequence, you end up with a kitchen that has your enormous Wolf stove in it and a huge hood up on top that's intended to deal with the exhaust gases and the extra heat that the stove is dealing with. Now, most people don't find themselves in a situation where they're finding themselves chilled in the kitchen because the Wolf stove's blowing all the heat in the house and sucking all the other heat in the room, you know, all the other warmed air in the room, up that exhaust with it. But that's because they're paying for the energy of the Wolf stove putting out 6,000 or 8,000 BTUs on each one of its burners, which is very happily kind of parasitically rewarming the room as it's doing everything else that it's doing. There is another type of cooking technology that doesn't involve direct application of heat. It does something rather more different. And it's been around for quite a while, and it's been getting quite a bit more sophisticated in the products that are available that demonstrate it. And that is called induction cooking. In this model, instead of applying heat to the pot, you do something a little more subtle. You apply a varying magnetic field to the pot. Now, the pot has to be made out of something magnetic, but that's okay because Granny's favorite fry pan was cast iron, and that'll do beautifully. That works out just perfectly. What ends up happening there is as you start putting that varying magnetic field into the pot, the magnetic domains have to start flipping back and forth in that iron. Okay, that sounds really techy. So let's imagine we've got a magnetic domain there and we're telling it to do some exercise. We're putting some energy into it, and so it starts marching along, doing its step aerobics and generating some heat in the process. It's got a light level of heat, a little bit of pink there, because we're not really making the little guy work that bad and work that hard. But if we really want to make our magnetic domains work hard, we'll hit it real hard with the field, and things get a lot hotter in a hurry. If I stop driving those magnetic domains right now, they stop moving. They stop moving, they stop generating heat. They stop generating heat, the pot starts cooling. There are some interesting implications to that. In a stove that uses this phenomenon, you don't have any blow-around heat loss. You don't have the overlap of the hot stovetop heating just air above it. You don't have the gas flowing, the gas flame flowing around the pot and heating up the sides. You have lower stovetop temperatures. I think probably my favorite, and John's heard this too many times, but my favorite factoid about these stoves is around what is, well, it's for guys, okay? We look at it as sort of the quarter-mile drag race of cooking, right? How long does it take to boil a pot of water? And you would think, you know, these enormous Wolf stoves that are roughly the size of a Volvo station wagon would win that, right? I mean, they put huge amounts of gas, huge amounts of heat, boil it like that. In point of fact, in those tests, a couple of interesting things happen. First of all, the induction stovetops win. The induction stovetops are faster than the big gas stoves that everyone would assume are the most efficient things out there. Secondly, when you drop the checkered flag at the end of the quarter mile and everyone's crossed the finish line, you've taken the pots off the stove, if you measure the temperature of the stove on either an electric resistance stove or on a gas stove, you'll find that the temperature of the top of that stove is something over 700 degrees Fahrenheit. This is to boil water to 212 degrees Fahrenheit at sea level. That's hot. That's a really hot surface, not a surface that you want to inadvertently come in contact with, as all of us have learned over time, right? I mean, you've burned your fingers on a stove more than once, I'm sure. The induction stovetop doesn't get hot to make the heat. It makes the pot get hot. The pot gets as hot as it needs to transfer energy to the water, and it turns out water is very good at taking energy away. That's why we run it in our cars and in our radiators and things like that. It's very good at pulling heat through metal and into itself and always presenting cool water to that surface. As a consequence, the heat at the top of the induction stove at the end of this drag race is about 230 degrees. Just very slightly higher than the boiling temperature of the water. This gives rise to some interesting phenomenon. The stove doesn't get hot. The pot does. And to the extent that the pot is in contact with the stove does. But as I mentioned before, that's a really bad thermal interface typically. The induction cooking system basically just reaches around that interface and cheats. It doesn't try to heat through it. It just tells this thing to get hot. That allows you to do a lot of amusing parlor tricks, which I can tell you about afterwards if you're interested. But overall, if you've ever been in a situation of simmering a marinara sauce for a few hours to really let it cook down, you know what the top of the stovetop looks like when you're done with that, right? Tomatoes splats everywhere, and you're just cleaning forever. With one of these stoves, you cover the whole stovetop with paper towels and let the thing simmer all day. And when you're all done, turn it off, pick up all the paper towels, throw them away. The stove didn't get hot. The consequence of all this is it is a device that allows for high efficiency performance of tasks that we do every day than we don't ordinarily think of as being particularly open to efficiency interventions. Next topic I want to talk about is LED lighting. LED lighting is a little problematic now because there are a lot of people playing with it. There are a lot of people making products like this beauty, a 60-watt bulb with Swarovski tech crystals on it or something. Not everyone who's in the game is really in the game. Some of the big firms that you would think would be just all over this are either kind of half on it, like Philips. Philips makes a lot of fluorescent and incandescent light bulbs, and they're kind of in the game in a big way, but not really effectively. Other companies like Osram and GE, you would think would be there in a big way. They're getting there slowly. But there are a few vendors out there that have got really genuinely efficient, really genuinely bright and pleasant lighting systems out there. Why do we care? Well, for one thing, an LED lighting system for a given level of brightness today takes about half as much power as a compact fluorescent. Those compact fluorescents that have disposal issues because they have mercury in them and, you know, that sort of good stuff. And I don't know about you, but I've never seen one last the 5,000 hours that they say on the package. It seems like I'm changing those things every year. One of the consequences of this is that these LEDs are comparatively expensive compared to incandescent bulbs or even compact fluorescents. But on the other time, on the other hand, they've got comparatively long lives. An incandescent bulb, a really good long-lived incandescent bulb, has a 1,500-hour operating life. An LED bulb is, generally speaking, spec'd to last 50,000 hours, which in most people's use of living room lighting, things like that, is 25 or 30 years of operation before you have to go back and revisit that bulb. That's interesting. It may be more expensive, but it's not 25 times more expensive. Maybe 15 times as expensive, right, John? It's not even that much. And LEDs are interesting in that they've got a bunch of different ways of actually making light, which is not obvious. Incandescent bulbs look a lot like the sun. Remember we had that pattern where there was a spike where there was visible light and then there's the long tail with infrared? Well, that long tail is where all the inefficiency of incandescent lights is. So you're giving off a tremendous amount of energy just heating the room. Again, I'll bet we've all had the opportunity in our youth of burning our fingers on an incandescent light bulb that had just recently been turned off or hadn't yet been turned off. That's that inefficiency that you're incorporating. With LEDs, they're generating light in one of two ways. They're either directly generating some light that you can look at and see by through the quantum effects that make LEDs work. There's a physicist or two in the audience, and we're not going to get into the quantum effects of LEDs, but those are things that make that beautiful red and the really bright blues and the strange yellows and all that. Those are directly created by the semiconductor dice. The other way you can make light is the same way that we make light with fluorescent bulbs, which is to excite a phosphor, make a phosphor in there get excited and emit photons as a result of it being excited, having its energy levels pumped up, and then dropping back down again. And that's used in a lot of the LEDs. If you see an LED that gives off white light, there ain't no such thing. Remember back at the beginning, white light is really a combination of all these other different colors? LEDs can put out one wavelength each. Pick your color, but that's the color they're going to do. And so if you get white light out of it, it's either because you've taken, for example, a red and a green and a blue LED and kind of put them in close proximity so the three of them adding up look white-ish, or you put a phosphor in front of it and the LED is doing something to drive the phosphor. And there are ultraviolet LEDs, there are bright blue LEDs. That's the way they get the white light. We've got both kinds in operation in the house for different purposes because the two of them operate very nicely in different types of light engines. What do I mean by a light engine? Well, an incandescent bulb is pretty straightforward, right? It's a bulb, it sits in a socket, you turn it on, it gives off light in all directions. A reflector bulb, a parabolic reflector bulb, a PAR bulb is a typical term for them, a little more subtle. It has a filament, and then it has a big glass reflector around it, so it throws light in a particular engine, in a particular direction. Those are two types of light engines. They're ways of taking a light-emitting device and generating useful illumination out of it. Depending on how you put these things together, LEDs have quite a number of different ways of generating light. We have some that are direct emission of white light, so phosphors, that come from a point source. And we have others that have red and orange lights inside them that mix them together inside the design of the device so that what gets presented to the world is a very diffuse, very broad, wide white light. So let me give you an example. This is a picture of the living room of the house the first night that the lights were fully installed. You can see, looking out the window at the sky, it's about half an hour after sunset in late fall. And that room is plenty bright. I mean, this isn't a camera running at 7,000 ASA or anything. It's just an ordinary little point-and-shoot camera that we took that with. That room is being lit in that shot on a late fall evening, half an hour after sunset, with 73 watts of power, or about the amount of power that you'd have in an ordinary end table lamp in an ordinary living room. That's a roughly 17 by 20-foot room that's being lit up with 73 watts of power. And it's beautiful light. It's really nice stuff. On to the last thing, home automation. You know, the first time I heard this phrase, I was very excited because I really thought it meant that. I had a wonderful conversation. I was in Sweden last week, and coffee is very important to the Swedes. And one afternoon, I was being taken up to the faculty lounge to have a cup of coffee. And the person I was with, we were commiserating that, here we are, it's 2010. Where the heck's my jetpack? Where's my flying car, Where's my home robot? And then he took his coffee cup and went over to the machine, hit a button that said cappuccino, and the machine proceeded to steam milk, pour it into the cup, grind the beans, tamp the beans and push water through it at high pressure and high temperature and made an immaculate cappuccino in about, I don't know, 20 seconds. That's where the robots went. The robots don't look like this guy. They look like coffee makers. They look like fancy water heaters. They look like a variety of devices that we have in our homes that do very specific tasks, and we have reasonably not spent the money to give them a human form so that they do the task the same way we do. They do it in a way that's very efficient and specific to the particular task. One way that notion of creating devices that are specific to tasks and kind of distributing through the environment, one way of thinking about that from a computational perspective is referred to by the term ubiquitous computing, as to say computing that's pretty much everywhere in a space. And that is the flavor of home automation that we're dealing with here. It's really kind of the third generation of home automation. The first generation was sort of the BSR X10 stuff that happened, I don't know, 20 or 30 years ago, where you could buy a thing from Radio Shack, plug your lamp into it, and then you bought another thing from Radio Shack. When you press this thing button over there, that thing over there turned the light on and off. And it was cool. It kind of worked most of the time until the things broke because they were cheap and not very well made. The second generation, we sat out. It was also the first generation of home automation that had anything to do with the world of the PC. And if you think about it, if you're trying to use home automation to reduce power consumption in your house, then having all of the automation in your house reliant on a 300-watt PC under someone's desk running 24 hours a day is probably a scenario you want to give a little thought to. It doesn't make that much sense. What we're dealing with now is computing that's distributed through the space and concentrated in a couple of places where there are a lot of rules and things accepted. And those places are sort of like 6 and 7 watt computer devices, the sort of power that the computer in your phone uses. These devices allow the house to have reflexes. One of the things that I haven't implemented yet, because Galen told me when we were moving into the house that I couldn't begin to look at programming the home automation until February at the earliest. So I haven't done much with it at all at this point. But you can create reflexes in the house so that it does things that are useful. For example, right now our front porch light is on. Why? Because the house knows that sunset happens at whatever it is, 6 o'clock or so these days. The time change is disorienting me. And so at sunset it turns the front porch light on, and at 11 o'clock at night it turns the front porch light off. We can do whatever we want to it in the meantime. If I turn it off earlier than that, that's fine. It won't turn it off again because it's smart enough to know that the switch is off. If it's not quite sure whether the switch is off or not, it can ask the switch, and the switch will tell it back again. It allows the house to anticipate needs. When I get up in the morning, the porch light goes on again at 20 minutes after the hour that I usually get up, at 4 in the morning. I've got a 5 o'clock workout. And then at 35 minutes after 4 o'clock, it turns it off again. Why? Because that's the hour that I need to go out and find my car in the driveway because it's bloody dark out there. But this is something that I don't have to engage with. It anticipates that that's going to happen 5 days a week, responds appropriately. It can also implement policies in the house. So, for example, if you have a pair of lights on a back staircase, as we do, you generally don't want to walk away and leave those lights on all night. So, for example, those lights in our house, when we turn them on with the switch in the house, the system notes that, and 30 minutes later, whether we've done anything about it or not, if those lights are still on, they're turned off. Likewise, in one room that has a halogen light in it, in a powder room in the house, if the lights get turned on there, that's fine. Half an hour later, those lights are going to be turned off again in a nice, discreet, dimmed-down, slowly way, but in a way that allows you to implement energy-saving policies within the reflexes of the house itself. Finally, sensor data response. The other thing that I often run into is, I often run into anything that might be out on the floor when I'm getting up and heading for the door at 4:30 in the morning. And I've been very pleased recently by a sensor device I put in the house where every morning I step out of the bedroom and a little red light across the room goes, bleep. It saw me. It saw my body heat. It doesn't do anything yet, but after another weekend or two, it will take that information that it sees something moving that is a human in the house and turn on some of the lights in the kitchen at a low level so that they are on. I can see my way around. I don't stumble over, you know, whatever things I may have left on the floor the night before. and then shut them off again as when that heat is no longer there. When I'm no longer stumbling around the living room, it can note that as well and turn that space off. This is not science fiction. This is not quite Home Depot yet, but getting there. This is pretty standard stuff and pretty easy to do at this point. So let me talk a little bit about what the light switch is in a space like this. It used to be the light switches were pretty much a fancy version of the thing that Igor used to operate for Dr. Frankenstein, right? He'd go over the light and he's crashing, and Igor would go over to the wall and go, "Yes, man, it's not clunk." And it's just two pieces of metal and another metal that rotates between them to tie them together. That's pretty much what a switch is these days. When you go to Home Depot and you buy a power switch or a light switch, that's what you're getting. Two pieces of metal with screws attached to them, the wires go to the screws, and then there's a little plastic toggly thing that moves another piece of metal back and forth, and that makes a circuit or not. Today, a little different. Today we've got a device that has a self-configuring networking device on it, a radio networking device, a CPU associated with it. And the CPUs have been around since, you know, the X10 stuff came out 20-something years ago. You have to have something there that recognizes, oh, my number is A4, and something's telling me to turn on. Okay, A4, turn on, click. But, of course, the things that could do that 25 years ago, you know, Moore's Law being what it is, think about what a computer was 25 years ago. Well, you probably, most of us can't think about what a computer was 25 years ago because we weren't dealing with them yet. But even in the amount of time that you've been playing with PCs, every year they get faster and more powerful. And as a consequence, the CPUs and light switches today are really smart. And so they can easily populate an entire house full of switches like that, establish a communications network between them, understand what the routing of communications from one device to another so they can implement things like the reflexes I was talking about and do that all internally. But they can also allow for smarter behavior when they're just being used as light switches. So, for example, in a bedroom light switch, I usually go to bed pretty early in the evening. The light switch is, at the moment, over on the wall where light switches are supposed to be. And the problem with that is my side of the bed's the other side of the bed on the other side of the room. So you turn the light off and then you kind of feel your way through the dark. Well, no, you don't, because this switch is smart enough to know that I want it to wait 3 seconds before it does anything when I hit it off. Only going off. Going on, I want it to go on immediately. But in going off, I want it to wait 3 seconds, and then I want it to take 10 seconds to ramp the light down in the room. So I've got 13 seconds to make it across a 13-foot room. I can do that. No matter how tired I am, I can do that. So I basically have a light switch that's smart enough to know it needs to stay on long enough for this fool to get to bed. Not a bad thing. So let's talk about lessons learned at this point to kind of wrap things up. We're finding with a lot of these green technologies that these are a wide range of rapidly changing techniques, materials, processes, and devices coming to a world that works with hammers. It's a traditional world. It's a traditionally conservative world, and we should be glad of that. That's what brings a lot of what we enjoy about our homes to us. But at the same time, there's a culture shift that is going to have to happen and is going to need to start taking place and will take place. The good news about that is that the folks who are engaged with these tools and are using them and are having experiences with them, good, bad, and indifferent, they're pretty identifiable at this point. You know, you can find them by just interviewing the potential contractors and handy people that you might have working on your house. That's a huge issue. That it extends beyond issues of contractors and people who are actually practitioners to the people who are dealing with regulatory stuff as well. Codes don't fully understand what the implications of new technologies are. For example, there was a wonderful story in the newspaper in San Jose Mercury News yesterday about a guy in Saratoga who was having a fight with Saratoga Town Hall. Why? Because he'd put in an artificial lawn. Now, this is a lawn that looks, it's in his backyard, it looks for all the world like a putting green at Augusta. I mean, it's this magnificent, beautiful stuff. Water can flow through it. It's wonderful. It's green. It's fantastic. It is as nice a lawn from an environmental perspective as a lawn can be. And lawns, generally speaking, especially in golf courses, are not nice environmentally. They're crazy concentrations of chemistry and water. So it seems like it's a good thing. Except that the codes in Saratoga right now, first of all, to prevent people just coming in and covering their entire property with concrete, are designed to require a maximum amount of impermeable ground coverage. Just for reference sake, one of the things that's listed as an impermeable ground cover in Saratoga is gravel. I haven't seen any standing water on a gravel driveway in a long time, but maybe that could happen. So it's a little wrong to start with, but where it gets really wrong is the way the law is written. If it's not specifically permitted by the law, it's forbidden. That's a difficult situation to be in when we found ourselves not in the world of computers and instruments and devices that we use at techie levels, but in technologies coming to the home, starting to experience the same kind of rapid change and churn that we've seen in many other parts of our lives. That kind of code is problematic and is going to need to change. Likewise, the inspectors who enforce those kinds of codes need to be educated, need to be continually brought up to speed on what's the newest thing this month, because it is going to be a nearly monthly change of practice and material. Finally, I mentioned before the monastic lifestyle is not something that people are standing in line to get into. I'm happy to report that our green home is absurdly comfortable. In the first month that we've had to operate the space without any construction going on in it or any unusual operations taking place, the power consumption of the house was down drastically, I mean just ridiculously. Since then, we've found some other optimizations that we could do, so we're expecting to go down even further. But anytime you can get into a place where the house is waiting for you at home and it's 67 or 68 degrees when you walk in the door, and shuts its own heat down later at night and is lovely and comfortable and quiet. By the way, that's the other thing that all that foam in the wall does. You hear nothing outside until you learn to listen for it, and then you can hear through it. But it's an extremely quiet space. This is what the inside of the living room looked like at 3:30 yesterday afternoon. The windows I mentioned before are still there. They're the one part of the house that survived the whole remodel, is the wall holding those windows. And as you can see, the sun is, in fact, streaming into the house from all surfaces and looking out at the trees beyond. The outside view of the house is this. Looking at it up from the canyon, you're looking at the windows there. And the context that our very green home is in is quite green itself.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Bob Smith about his personal experiences as a homeowner and designer in restoring his old cabin. We've come, unfortunately, to the end of our program, but I have one burning question. And my question is, what was the most frustrating thing about doing this work?
The most frustrating?
Were there none?
Oh, no, there were many. I think probably the most frustrating thing about it was living in another home in the neighborhood while this construction was going on, because the other home in the neighborhood had not been upgraded as far as our cabin had been, and we'd found our cabin to be unacceptable. This other place was scary. I mean, bats, the only heat in the place was wood stoves. Bats were flying down the chimneys and flying around inside the houses. The really rustic cabins are still out there, and that was not fun.
Our thanks to Bob for sharing his experiences and being with us here tonight. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club is now adjourned. Thank you.